Are we live?
All
right. Okay, we'll call the meeting to order of the Public Safety Policy and Finance Committee and start out with a roll call.
Cornish.
Here.
Woodard.
Here.
Mullery.
Present.
Gothier.
Here.
Grunhagen.
Here.
Hilty. Johnson.
Here.
Kelly.
Here.
Kreisel. Leidiger.
Here.
Mariani. McDonald.
Here.
Moran.
Here.
Nornis.
Here.
Slocum. Smith.
Okay, and we've got a quorum. We'd like somebody to make a motion to approve the minutes of March 16th.
So moved. I'll make a motion.
Representative McDonald moves the minutes of March 16th. Any additions or corrections? Seeing none, all in favor of approval, say aye.
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 Opposed? I'm afraid that's going to fail. All right. Representative Mueller, would you mind going first, or are you ready to go? Okay, thank you. Change the order here a little bit. Give me more time to think about my bills.
They need me.
Yeah.
So if there's anything he did.
Representative Mueller, have you been informed where your bill is going?
Pardon?
Judiciary? Would
yes,
you
I found that out.
Okay, you want to move it?
Mr. Chairman, I'll move passage and send it to the Judiciary Committee.
Okay. Representative Mullery moves 1103 for recommended to pass and go to the Judiciary Policy and Finance. And Representative Mullery, the bill is before us, and you can may proceed however you would like.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And first of all, Mr. Chair, since you and I are both known for meaningful ties, this morning I wore a tie that has shamrocks on it, and I thought of Representative Grunhagen, who was able to figure out a way to introduce God into each discussion, and that was the way that St. Patrick taught the Irish about the Trinity. And last night, Mr. Chair, I had a dream that I captured a leprechaun, and according to ancient Irish lore, if you catch a leprechaun, they give you three wishes. And usually people ask for pots of gold, but in this committee, Mr. Chair, I decided to ask that the chair learn and go along with our wishes on each of the issues in this committee. So remember, you can't set aside ancient Irish lore.
He might be English.
If wishes were fishes, we'd have some fried. Sounds good. I'm just glad when your wishes were done that I'm still sitting in this chair.
Mr. Chair, I just said that was one of the three ways.
Okay. Better watch out then. Okay, Representative Mullery, go ahead and present.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is something that I don't think any of us realized, but at the present time in our law, if let's say a water meter reader from the city is assaulted when they're out working, it's a gross misdemeanor. But if a person is called out, for instance, I believe it's Centerpoint Energy, for instance, that has the gas, if a pipe fitter is called out to fix the gas leak so that the house doesn't explode and kill everybody on the block, if they're assaulted, it's only a misdemeanor. And this really doesn't make any sense, because they are even more, the utility workers are even more required to get out to the property than some of the city workers are required to do it. So this would just make it, for the utility workers and for the postal employees, a gross misdemeanor, just like it already is for a city water meter person who's out there. And this morning, we have Carl Crimmins from the pipe trades and a few more people who are on their way, and some are here. So, and then there's some of the corporations are also here to say they support it.
Okay, sir, if you state your name and title and go ahead with your testimony.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Carl Crimmins. I'm the president of the Minnesota Pipe Trades Association, and we represent the gas workers at CenterPoint Energy, and we support this legislation. We feel that it's some backup for the worker that's out there on his own working out of a service truck at all times of day or night, that they should have a little more comfort when they're performing their duties. And with that, I can stand for any question.
Any questions so far, or should we bring up a couple more testifiers?
Yes, Mr. Chair. The next witness would be Pam Donato, the head of the letter carriers. And we were going to throw a north side at you this morning. Pam was actually a student of my mom's when my mom taught at Ascension, and also when Sister Mary Hasbrook, who was here and knew Representative McDonald's aunts very well. So there's a connection already.
Okay. Ma'am, go ahead and state your name. And
good morning. My name is Pam Donato, and I'm a letter carrier for the U.S. Postal Service. I'm currently serving as a full-time president of the National Association of Letter Carriers, Branch 9 in Minneapolis. And we support this legislation as we feel it would help our letter carriers who are out on the street 6 days a week entering people's yards to deliver their mail, in order to support the fact that if they are assaulted, and they often are, while performing those duties, that there would be support and a consequence that we would be able to follow up on with regard to those carriers going back out the very next day and continuing delivery service. Right now, we don't have enough consequence for the carriers that are assaulted because while it is a federal crime to assault a postal employee in the performance of their duties, very rarely will the U.S. Attorney's Office prosecute such a crime unless it involves a very horrific injury. And we feel that this legislation would help put some teeth into a consequence for letter carriers that go out and perform their work each day.
Okay, thank you very much for your testimony. Next testifier, you state your name and title, and go ahead and slide up to the mic there.
Yeah, good morning, Mr. Chair. Happy St. Patrick's Day. My name is Timothy M. Donovan. I'm the president of CWA Local 7200 in Minneapolis. We represent workers that for Quest, and our technicians are on duty 24/7. What we do is, have 911, which is needed, which could, life and death situations. And the people we represent go out to fix these. I just want to let you know that we're definitely in support of this bill, and we have had incidents where we've had technicians beaten, robbed, and actually we had one shot, and he's disabled this day. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Sir, go ahead.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. My name is Andy Schreiner. I'm the Director of Government Affairs for Quest, and I'm here to support Representative Mullery's legislation. As Mr. Donovan said, our employees are very vulnerable when they're out in their job, often working in the evening in the dark, working with their back to the street, and don't see people coming up from behind. And this legislation, we think, is important to help safeguard our employees. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
And Mr. Chair, also, I received a call from Grania McKiernan, who is one of the lobbyists for Xcel Energy, and she said they support it. She's also 100% Irish, I believe. Her brother sat next to me at St. Thomas in class, so she's maybe already out for St. Patrick's Day, I'm not sure. But I think we could add more to the testimony, but I think people understand the danger for utility employees. They have to go out there to help the people in their homes, and it's only fair that they be protected. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for your testimony. I haven't uncovered a lot of controversy or problems with your bill. We will take questions if you folks have any. I think the fiscal note isn't done yet, but it's very minimal, if anything. All right. Well, thank you very much for your testimony, folks, and coming in. Thank you, Representative Mullery, for your bill. Would you any opposition? Seeing none. Yes.
Mr. Chairman, I just noticed another one. I'll just say that he was supposed to be here as a witness, Dave Ibarra, also from the pipe trades. He just got here. Another Northsider that's head of one of the coalitions.
Mm-hmm. Representative Munley, would you like to restate your motion?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Move passage of the bill and send it to the Judiciary Committee.
Okay, thank you. The Representative Mullery moves House File 1103, recommended to pass, and move to Judiciary Policy and Finance. Any comments or questions from the members? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Thank you, Representative Mullery. Bill passes.
Okay.
What order?
Representative Cornish, would you like to move House File 738?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House File 38, the held over for possible inclusion into the omnibus bill.
Okay, Representative Cornish moves House File 738 for possible inclusion in a later bill. And to your bill.
Mr. Chair and members, House File 738 comes to us in its second hearing. It was in Judiciary before and came here. This is about restraining orders and expands venue options for prosecution of violations and talks about electronic communications and where these violations of law may be prosecuted in the counties that they originated in or received in. And I'd like to introduce my testifier, Ms. Liz Richards. Mr. Chair?
Oh, go ahead, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Ms. Richards.
Chair, members of the committee, I'm Liz Richards. I'm with the Minnesota Coalition for Battered Women. We're a coalition of statewide membership organization with 85 domestic violence member programs from across the state. I'm here to testify in support of House File 738, which amends the harassment restraining order law. As I'm assuming you're aware, there are three different distinct types of restraining orders under Minnesota state law. There's the criminal domestic abuse no contact order, there is the family court order for protection, and there is the civil court harassment restraining order. These modifications go to the civil harassment restraining order. And there are two proposed changes. The first has to do where violations of the harassment restraining order may be prosecuted. These changes are the same modifications that were made to the stalking statute last year. And the first is that if a respondent commits multiple acts that are violations of a harassment restraining order, they may be, rather than having each county file and prosecute their violations separately, they can be prosecuted by any of the involved counties. For example, if a petitioner lives in Dodge County and the respondent violates the restraining order at her home, and she works in Olmsted County, and the respondent comes to her workplace and violates the restraining order at her workplace, either Dodge or Olmsted County could prosecute both offenses. So it streamlines that process. The second proposed change is needed to keep up with some of the changing technology, and it addresses violations done through communication. So everything from phone calls, letters, to electronic communications such as text and email. And it clarifies an offense can be charged either where the communication originates or where it is received. And that's in line with criminal statutes and case law. It also deals with electronic communications where it is often more difficult to determine when a crime actually occurs and where it actually occurs. And so that raises some of these venue questions. So the questions become, you know, when did the respondent actually send the message, from where was he when he sent the message by text? And so this language will then mirror the stalking statute language and provide some clarity around those communication issues. The harassment restraining order is an important tool to provide safety for sexual assault, domestic violence, and stalking victims. However, if the harassment restraining order violations cannot be prosecuted because there's confusion over venue, these orders lose their effectiveness. These changes provide clarity on the venue issues, streamline enforcement and prosecution. I urge you to support House File 738. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Richards. Is there any questions from the members for Ms. Richards? Okay, seeing none. Are there any opposition? Any members of the public who would like to speak in opposition? Okay, sir, come on down. And please state your name for the record, sir.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Michael Harrison. I am the Director of Judicial Common Sense. We have some concerns with this bill. One of the first concerns we have is on lines 1.110 and 2.25. It states another person. We believe that this will make this law ambiguous because it doesn't define who another person is. Our concern is, could we attach this restraining order onto maybe a relative of the respondent or whatever? So we believe that there should be more clarification. Who is, I would assume that it would be the respondent should be the word, but I'm assuming against the person who the order is against. The other concern that we have is that between the language between 4.16 and 4.2, where they talk about multiple counties being able to prosecute this. First of all, Minnesota Constitution, Article 1, Section 6, and the U.S. Constitution, Amendment 6 states that the defendant or offender of a crime will be prosecuted in the county in which the crime had committed. So therefore, we would believe that this statute would now become unconstitutional and would leave grounds for appeals down the road. Unfortunately, yes, it might make it easier. One of our members had a situation, but this involved an order for protection, where his estranged wife was in a shelter in St. Cloud, which was Stearns County. The women's advocacy group that was helping her was in Monticello, which is Wright County, and he used his cell phone to make a phone call to the advocacy group in Monticello, which the phone rolled over to the shelter in St. Cloud. The problem was Hennepin County had nothing, a knowledge of this crime or anything, so they were out of the midst. But there got to be a dispute between Stearns County and Wright County who prosecutes this person. He actually had charges filed in both counties for that violation, which again is unconstitutional, because you can only be punished for the crime once. So our concern would be then, who's the county that would get priority over this conviction if both counties or three counties, whatever, wanted to fight it? There's no language specifying that. Thank you very much for allowing me to testify.
Thank you, Mr. Harrison. Any questions from members? Right. Anyone else from the public who would like to speak in opposition or in support of this bill? Okay, seeing none. Any further discussion from members? Seeing none of that, would you like to any closing comments and move your renew your motion to move the bill?
I would just renew the motion to hold the bill over for possible inclusion of the omnibus finance bill.
All right,
Mr. Chair.
House File 738 is held over for possible inclusion in another bill. And Representative Cornish to House File 1072. Would you like to move that bill?
Mr. Chair and members, what I'd like to do is pull this bill over for possible inclusion in. Is there an amendment in your packet? I have an A1A amendment here.
Yes. There is a 1A amendment. Is that an author's amendment, Representative Cornish?
I believe it is.
Okay. All right. Would you like to move that amendment?
Yes, I'd like to move the amendment 1A onto the House File 1072.
Okay. Any discussion on amendment 1A? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed?
1072.
Okay, motion carries. Amendment. Is the bill or the House file now in the order in which you would like it?
Yes, and Mr. Chair and members, what I would like to do, rather than stumble through a poor explanation of a very complex subject, basically what this does is, to be totally transparent to my members, this sets us up to do what we consider a savings in the budget for the public safety, and it transfers certain people out of the correctional plan, non-correctional, into a different plan, whereby saving some money. And Mr. Diebel, would you like to walk through the schematics of it, or I could bring Mr. Martin up too?
Mr. Martin, let's let you testify.
Mr. Martin here comes in the capacity just to provide information, not especially support or non-support. So I'll let him testify as to the mechanics of what it does.
Thank you. Go ahead, Mr. Martin.
Yes, members. I'm Larry Martin. I'm the Executive Director of the Legislative Commission on Pensions and Retirement. I should note that the Legislative Commission on Pensions has not been totally formed yet. There are still appointments that need to be made, and the commission has no position on this bill, has not reviewed the bill. I've prepared the 1A amendments. What the bill does with the 1A amendments is it relates to employees in both the Department of Corrections and the employees in the Department of Human Services. It changes retirement coverage for some of those employees, and it also has to do with an employer-paid post-retirement health insurance eligibility. I principally understand other retirement plan changes. I can help you to some extent on the post-retirement health coverage issues. There's a special retirement plan for correctional officers that was set up in 1973. Before 1973, all correctional employees were covered by the General State Employees Retirement Plan. In 1973, for certain protective or security positions in the prison and certain, principally Stillwater, and for certain security positions at the St. Peter's Security Hospital, a special pension plan was set up. Over the years, that plan has been expanded as to its membership to include individuals other than just the correctional officers and the security counselors at the DHS facilities. What the bill does is it eliminates from the plan coverage, effective July 1, all of the non-security positions, all of the positions essentially that have been added to the plan since 1973. This is about a third of the coverage of the retirement plan. The second article makes a change with respect to post-retirement health coverage. One of the provisions or one of the advantages of the special correctional retirement plan is our retirement at age 55. This is a considerable period of time before an individual becomes eligible for Medicare coverage. And what the state does under bargaining is provide employer-paid health insurance coverage for the period between age 55 and eligibility for Medicare. Several of the contracts, as I understand it, just required that someone receive an MSRS correctional plan, a retirement annuity, to be eligible for this employer-paid health coverage. This changes bargaining agreements in places where no minimum period of service is specified, and provides that there must be a 10-year minimum period of service before one is eligible for the special health coverage.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Martin. Any questions for Mr. Martin from the members? Representative Mallory.
Definitely. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Martin. First of all, I thought under PELRA that health care was a collective bargaining issue.
Mr. Martin?
And if so, wouldn't this be a great change from what's collective bargaining? I'll ask all my questions at once. So another, I'm just trying to figure out all of, you went through it fairly quick and it seems like there's quite a bit in this. Is there, as you know, most of the cases around the country have always held that you couldn't change anything except prospectively, probably over 90% of the cases. Is there anything in all of this, rather than us trying to figure out, is there anything in all this that would be a violation of that? Is there anything that's not only prospective? That's my second question.
Mr. Martin?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mullery, with respect to PELRA provisions, I'll defer to your counsel. PELRA does not extend to retirement benefit coverage. Retirement benefits and contributions are not mandatory items for bargaining under PELRA, and that's about the extent of my understanding of PELRA in any detail.
Mr. Chairman, I knew that it didn't, that it specifically excludes pension issues, but I thought you were talking about health care coverage, which I think is different, isn't included in the pension, but I think is a collective bargained issue.
Mr. Martin?
Yes, Mr. Chair, the bill as amended does cover health care coverage, post-retirement health care coverage for current employees when they do retire. There are collective bargaining agreements that make provision for that health care coverage. This changes those PELRA collective bargaining agreements.
Oh, okay, that was my question, whether we're changing PELRA, and apparently we are.
Mr. Chair, you're not changing PELRA, you're changing collective bargaining agreements.
Representative Mallory?
Well, Mr. Chairman, maybe we can have counsel explain how, if PELRA allows those collective bargaining agreements, how we can then break a contract that was entered into legally at the time.
Mr. Diebel, do you have a comment on that one? Okay, let's, Representative Moore, we have another testifier that may be able to answer that for us. So let's.
Okay, fine.
If
I
we
just
can do
think
that.
That's an important question.
Okay, thank you. Any other
question?
Go ahead,
that,
Mr. Martin.
Was asked has to do with the protections that a public employee has to public employee pension benefits. This is a change in the benefit coverage for the roughly one third of the plan membership of the correctional plan. They would have general state employee pension plan coverage after July 1, 2011. They have enhanced benefit coverage currently. That is likely to be viewed as a diminution of their benefits. In this state, under the Christensen case from 1983, we don't have a contract theory of public employee pension benefits. We have a quasi-contract or a promissory estoppel theory of public employee pension coverage. The court here is not terribly concerned about how the arrangement was formed as in a contract and whether all the particular requirements of a contract were all met. But if it looks enough like a contract, the court treats any sort of arrangement as to pensions as a contract. If there has been reliance on the provisions of the arrangement, the state or whatever other entity is estopped from, under a promissory estoppel theory, from acting inconsistent with that arrangement. That's a 1983 case. It applied to a change in retirement age for a city council member in Minneapolis, and it is the general law as we understand it. There's not been a specific case, to my understanding, that has to do with changing in prospective pension plan coverage. And so that would be something that would be conjecture on my part to know, to try and give you any sense about how that would necessarily apply to this case.
Mr. Chairman, and I've done a lot of research, as you know, on the, and the 93 case on the Minneapolis teachers basically upheld the Christensen decision again. And the reliance is the big word, and I'm wondering, my question, I guess, would be, is this only prospective as to new employees, or does it apply? Then there's a real problem, I think, if it applies to existing employees. So, because of the reliance issue.
I assume that the individuals involved would view this as a diminution in their benefits, and that they rely on their current benefit coverage, and that they likely would litigate, yes.
Thank you. Okay. I was afraid of that.
Representative Grunhagen.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I've gotten some emails from constituents on this bill, and I'm just voicing one of their questions for your response.
Okay, Ms. Martin.
The question is, House File 1072, which will remove all job classes but security councils and correctional retirement at Minnesota Security Hospital, including those who have been paying for many years. No grandfathering. They will go back and have our money that was paid in corrections for over 15 years returned to the general fund. Could you respond to that?
Mr. Martin?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Representative, the amendment changes some of what's described there. That would be an accurate description of the bill as introduced. The amendment removed some of the provisions which would, the bill as drafted, would place these individuals both for prospective and past service credit in the general employee plan and refund to them the difference between the general plan coverage and the correctional plan coverage member contribution rate.
So they get their money back that they put in.
Representative Grunhagen?
In the bill as introduced, they would have. As Representative Cornish has now amended the bill, these individuals would retain their MSRS correctional plan coverage through July 1 of 2011. They will get a benefit eventually, which will be a composite of their correctional plan coverage and their general plan coverage. We have a portability mechanism with combined service annuity and state statute that allows tacking together time using a common high five, and individuals would get a benefit that somewhat resembles what they would have had they stayed in either of the two plans. Now, the plans differ as to retirement ages, and there are going to be certain differences, so it's not generally the thrust of what the portability provision does, but would not apply cleanly here or as well as it might otherwise. So the amendment takes out any impact on past service credit and eliminates any refund need as a consequence.
Representative Grunhagen.
Just for clarification purposes, so based on your response, to summarize, the grandfathering provision has been eliminated under the amendment.
Mr. Martin.
Those who have been in the plan can stay there. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair.
Not exactly. What happens is they keep their past service credit. Their future service would not be covered by the correctional plan, would be covered by the general plan. So accrued benefits to date would be grandfathered, if you want to look at it that way. Or there would be no retroactive application of the transfer between pension plans to cover past service by existing employees.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah.
Thank you. And let's hear from Mr. Bergstrom. And Mr. Bergstrom, if you can state your name and title for the record, please.
Mr. Chair, I do have a handout.
Okay, if you can pass that along to the page, please.
Mr. Chair, my name is Dave Bergstrom, and I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota State Retirement System.
We are not here in support or opposition to the bill, but I would like to walk through the pension implications of the bill and what impact it would have on the Minnesota State Retirement System. And the handout, I hope, will help kind of simplify a relatively complex discussion. The bill does move about 1,400 employees for future service from our correctional plan to the general employees retirement plan. I will say all of the actuarial work is based on work we did in 2009. There was a similar provision introduced in the governor's budget that did not pass. So we have asked for updated actuarial work, but it will take a couple of weeks. We have a lot of actuarial work that we have been requested to do, and we're working through the many requests. So maybe what I'd like to do is just go back to one. I have the benefits on one side and the actuarial impact on the other. So maybe we could look at the benefit and the impact. So what this does for future service is moves people from the correctional plan to the general plan. And as Mr. Martin alluded to, there are some significant differences in those plans. The correctional plan has full retirement at age 55. The general plan has full retirement at 65 or 66, depending on when you were hired. The retirement formula for the correctional plan is 2.4% a year. We did lower it to 2.2% per year for new hires last year. And the general plan has 1.7%. So an example A, I took somebody who was 55 with a $4,000 monthly salary, and their monthly benefit, 25 years times 2.4% is 60% of their high five, and their monthly benefit would be $2,400 a month. So somebody who retired tomorrow would get $2,400 a month with 25 years of service. Okay. Example B, fast forwards 10 years. So now the employee who had 15 years in the correctional plan as of July 1 and the 10 years forward in the general plan, they would get $1,440 from the correctional plan. So that service would stay there and they would receive $388 from the general plan. The amount is considerably less because of the early retirement reduction. So their total benefit would be $1,800 a month. If we fast forwarded another 25 years and now they have no correctional plan services, all in the general plan, their monthly benefit would be $969 a month. As a practical matter, nobody would retire with that because they couldn't afford to retire, but they would then work longer and delay their retirement. So one of the discussions that from a policy standpoint is, you know, what age do you want people working in correctional facilities to retire? So that's kind of just a very quick summary of the benefit effect that this bill has. If we turn over to the next page, we look at the financial impact. There are two things happening in this bill. One is there's a savings because the contribution rates to our correctional plan from an employer are significantly higher than our general plan. The employer contribution rate to our correctional plan is 12.1. The employer contribution to our general plan is 5%. What happens, however, when you do this change is the unfunded liability in the program for those people who are moving out stays with that correctional plan, and fewer people are paying it, which drives up the cost to our correctional plan. So on one hand, you're saving money because the state's contribution is less, but we are going to, I will be pushing very hard to make sure that the employer contribution goes up to cover the additional cost of our correctional plan. Because if not, it will deteriorate the funding of that plan. To make this akin is, let's say we all bought a house together and we had a mortgage. and half of the rooms stayed in to pay off the mortgage, and half of the room moved out, the mortgage cost for those people staying in would go up, to kind of try to simplify that. So to put this in numerical terms, if we could start on the page that talks about the funding. Our total correctional plan payroll, this would be for Department of Corrections, Department of Human Services, is $205 million. So that's the employees who are paying in. If you added up all of their salaries, that would be the $205 million. We then split that into security personnel and non-security personnel, because the non-security personnel are going to be switching plans. They're now going to be in our general employees retirement plan. So roughly looking at that split, again, we're using a little bit, not perfectly accurate numbers, but pretty close. So the non-security personnel on the right side, that would have a payroll of $71 million times the 12.1% employer contribution. So if they were left where they were, their cost to the state would be $8.7 million per year. If we drop down a box, now if you take that same $71 million salary and multiply it by 5%, they're going to contribute $3,590. The state is going to contribute $3,597 million. So there is a savings in contributions of a little over $5 million, okay, from the employer's standpoint. So this bill saves in employer contributions for those non-personnel employees about $5 million. If you then switch to the left side, the security personnel have a salary of about $133 million at 12.1%. Their contribution would be $16 million a year. However, the state's cost is going to go up by 2.3%. So, and this is based on 09 numbers, it could potentially be higher because of our unfunded liability is higher. So the cost to pay off that unfunded liability with a smaller group increases the cost of our correctional plan by 2.3%, which has an additional cost of approximately $3 million. So what you do is you take the savings from the lower contribution for the non-security personnel, subtract the additional cost for the security personnel, and you end up with a potential net savings of about $2 million. Part of that savings would accrue to the Department of Corrections. That would be about $470,000 a year. The rest would go to the Department of Human Services. That would be about $1.5 million per year. So I guess the bottom line is that there are savings that are offset somewhat by the additional cost. If I had to guess, I think the savings could end up slightly less than this, because when we did this last, as you all know, the markets didn't do so well for a couple of years. So our unfunded grew roughly in the neighborhood of $60 million in this plan. So that unfunded now has grown. I don't have that number. I will get that number to you. And I can't speculate, because there's all sometimes weird things that happen when you do actuarial studies that make me glad I'm not an actuary. So, but essentially what I'm trying to say is the bottom line savings would be about $2 million per year.
And Mr. Bertram, before I get to Representative Gaultier, just a quick question on the Department of Human Services savings that we're talking about here. Are these, would those be employees like at Moose Lake?
They would be, Mr. Chair, it would be all Department of Human Services. I don't have with me exactly where they work. I think there are other agencies as well. Okay. Some likely would be in Moose Lake. Roughly speaking, Human Services has 672 non-security positions.
Okay, thank you.
The Corrections has 806, but the Department of Corrections have more employees, obviously.
Okay. And then just one more quick question for you, too, then on the general plan that we're talking about, which state employees are currently under the general plan?
Most state employees are under the general plan. The state agency employees, me, a lot of, by far most of our employees are covered by the general plan. You know, the people who work in DOT, the people who work in DHS, MMB. We also cover University of Minnesota employees, Met Council employees. So
okay.
We have about 50,000 members in our general plan, about 4,000 or so in this program. So
okay.
Just to give you an understanding.
Good. Representative Gauthier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Bergstrom, you state here that the employer contribution for security personnel is 12.1%. And you also stated that you would push for a increase in that to offset the loss. Do you have a ballpark figure of percentage that you're looking at?
Mr. Bergstrom?
Mr. Chair, approximately 2.3%. And that would apply to the security personnel over on the left side. So that $133 million payroll, that would be roughly a 2.3. My guess is that's going to go up slightly based on the unfunded liability we currently have, but I'll get those numbers as soon as I can.
Mr. Chair,
go ahead.
So we're talking about 14.5.
Okay. Mr. Bergeron?
Thank you.
Mr. Okay. Chair, that's correct.
Representative Grunhagen.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate your example of the people living in the house and the mortgage, but I would add one perspective to that. I can see what you're saying, but you'd still, by having the people move out of the house, you would slow the growth of the mortgage, though, long term. Because ultimately you're changing the benefit structure for those employees to the general plan, which is resulting in a lower benefit. Okay? So ultimately, even though the people move out, if I, as a state, okay, the growth of the mortgage is being reduced if you look at both plans together. Would that be correct?
Mr. Bertram?
Mr. Chair, that would be correct. You know, ultimately there is a savings. I guess my point is that there's also going to be a cost, and we just need to take that into account. But you are correct. The benefit for the employees that are moved out, the value of that goes down over time.
Thank you. I'd like to just pause for a moment here and welcome the high school students from Homeschool Adventures who are here as part of the historical Capitol tour. So welcome. Welcome to the committee. And Representative Kelly.
And Mr. Chair,
go ahead, Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. In either case, in either one of the plans, they're both still defined benefit plans, correct?
Mr. Chair, that is correct.
Okay. Representative Kelly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Bruce, I just have a couple questions on your examples. What is the employee's portion?
Mr. Chair, the employee contribution to the correctional plan is 8.6%.
8.6%. So is that included in all the examples then? So you've got example A there with the total monthly benefit being $2,400. Does that include the employee's portion?
Mr. Bruce?
Mr. Chair, it does, yep. The contributions in our traditional pensions, really, where they come from, I mean, it matters, but it's not really derived, you know, the benefit's not derived from that. It's based on years of service and high five salary. But that is part of the funding of the program.
Okay. Mr. Chair.
Representative Kelly, go ahead.
Then going down to example C, then when you've put the monthly contribution down to the general plan and you did that calculation, did that still have the employee's portion in there?
Mr. Bertram.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kelly, yes, the employees would pay 5% into the general plan. So inevitably the employees are paying. There's just a difference in the level of how much they're paying.
Okay, Mr. Chair.
Kelly?
And I guess that would be my point, that 3% that they're paying now, you actually don't have that calculated into the benefit then. So it would actually be greater than that, right?
Mr. Bertram?
Mr. Chair, President Kelly, if they took that money, invested it, and saved it, it would help offset the difference.
Okay.
I was just trying to kind of give a very simple example.
Right, and I appreciate that, Mr. Chair. But they're already paying the 8%, so we should really account for that still being out there, so we would have to add that to that bottom line. And then just one other question, Mr. Chair, if I could, on what would be the savings to the general plan then with this infusion of employees into it?
Mr. Bertram?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kelly, there could be a cost to the general plan because you are bringing in, as a group, older employees. These people have been established. They are tend to maybe be older, so they have a shorter time to pay in and earn return on. So I didn't have that done because it's in the scope of a 50,000 plan. It's probably not enough to kind of show up, but I'm not sure there would be a savings. I would speculate that there would be a minor cost because this group of employees is mature, more likely to stay around to retirement and have a cost to the program.
Representative Kelly?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess a follow-up to that then is, that's a little confusing to me then, because if this same group stays in the other plan, aren't they the mature group and would add significant cost to that plan?
Mr. Bertram?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kelly, they do add costs, but they also are paying in, and the employer is paying in, and the young folks are paying in. So the future employees keep coming in if they pay. So you get a different dynamic, with an ongoing group than you do with a changing group. For example, when these employees were moved from our general plan to the correctional plan, there was a cost because they were older than most of our membership. From a retirement standpoint, the older you are when you come in, two things happen. You're more likely to collect, and you're paying in for a shorter period of time. So there is some kind of dynamic there.
Representative Kelly?
I'll be done here. Okay, thank you.
Mr. Bertram, just a quick question from me then. On the general plan, what is the retirement age for the general plan?
Mr. Chair, for employees hired before 1989, the full retirement age is 65, unless they qualify for the rule of 90, and that's where age and years of service, total 90, age 60 with 30 years of service. Okay. Anybody hired after 1989, it is age 66.
66, okay. Thank you. Any further questions for Mr. Bertram? Okay, I know we've got, this being a public hearing, I know we have some members of the public who would like to testify to this. I would like to ask that those testifiers limit their testimony to 2 minutes. I would appreciate that. And let's see, I know we've got on the list here Mr. Liefert, would like to testify. And please state your name for the record, please, Mr. Liefert.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and representatives of the committee. My name is Andy Liffert. I'm a 20-year veteran of the Department of Corrections, and I'm a caseworker assigned at the correctional facility at Stillwater. I'm here today to speak against the proposed legislation that removes all job classifications but correctional officers from the Corrections Early Retirement Program. Like the correctional officers, caseworkers like myself work directly with the offender population, oftentimes in one-on-one situations, in offices and spaces that aren't directly observed by the line staff or the correctional officers. Caseworkers receive much of the same training that officers receive, and there is an expectation that any and all staff available respond to crisis situations. Many of us are officed inside the cell blocks, which are inside the secure perimeters. Excuse me. Like officers, we take risks every day that we report to work. Minnesota prisons are becoming more and more violent with increases in violence, including staff assaults reported at each facility. I respectfully ask that you do not support this piece of legislation and leave the Corrections Early Retirement Program intact.
Thank you, Mr. Liefert, and thank you for your service. Mr. Grief is also on the list. Would you like to testify? And please state your name for the record, please, sir.
Morning, Mr. Chairman. My name is Scott Griffey. Spelled G-R-E-F-E. I work for Minnesota Council, Ask Me Council 5. Prior to that, I did have the privilege of working for just short of 16 years at the Minnesota Security Hospital in St. Peter as a security counselor. And to try to kind of put a face on this, we've talked a lot about numbers. I would echo Mr. Leifer's comments. We represent many other people that work in various institutions, Minnesota Sex Offender Program, both in Moose Lake and St. Peter, the Minnesota Security Hospital, and the Minnesota Extended Treatment Options in Cambridge. And we do have members and employees that are under the part of the this legislation that will be repealed. And those folks that work in those jobs, work therapy assistants, that work in vocational operations, licensed practical nurses, are in the trenches every day along with these security people, doing a job many times again, one-on-one with clients. In the Minnesota, Sex Offender Program, we have clients there that come directly out of prisons. They don't pass gold or they don't collect $200. They go right from prison. They go to the Minnesota Sex Offender Program, and our members and state employees are there working with those folks day in and day out. And we're not included in this plan just by happenstance. There was a thorough review. They have to meet these 75% requirements in order to participate in the plan. And I think it's working well, and we should leave the legislation as is. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Griffey, and apologies for the grief instead of Griffey.
That's not the worst one I've ever heard. All
right, thank you, Mr. Griffey. Do you have a question, Representative Maury, for
yes,
Mr. Griffey?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I don't know somebody from the system. I remember from several years ago talking to a few people who were, I think they were like counselors, or they were working with some of the partly mentally ill ones, and they were talking about getting hit and beat and things like that. Would they be correctional officers? If I thought they wouldn't be. I didn't think they were security because they were more trying to work with them on a mentally illness basis, and yet they were being assaulted. Would they fall with? Which would they fall within? I guess I don't know. I didn't know what.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, they could fall under many different job categories. The people that are mainly responsible for security in these facilities, the Minnesota Sex Offender Program, Minnesota Security Hospital, and then the Minnesota Extended Treatment Options would either be security counselors, security counselor leads, or human services support specialists. But as I stated earlier in my comments, that they are also, we have LPNs, work therapy assistants, and WTA, or WTTs, work therapy technicians, and others that work right along these primary security people. And as was stated earlier in testimony, when something happens of a critical situation, like a physical assault, and they happen quite frequently, everyone is expected to respond. Everyone has been trained the same. They all are required to take the same type of training. It's been called by different things, but it's personal safety techniques right now. And they're all expected to be there, all hands on deck, to be, in order to quell that situation. So it could be many of the people. Some of them are enumerated in the front of the legislation, and many of them are included in the piece that is being proposed for the repealer.
Representative Moore, do you have a call? Representative Johnson.
I'll wait till testimony.
Okay, thank you. Representative Hilty, would you
thank
question
you,
for Mr. Griffey?
For Mr. Griffey.
Thank you.
Mr.
Griffey.
Mr. Griffey, Representative Hilty has a question for you. Sorry about that.
Sorry.
Go ahead, Representative Hilty.
Mr. Griffey, from your experience in these institutions, would you say, I mean, I think if we're not aware, we should be aware that virtually everyone who works in one of these facilities has occasion to come in contact with the people that are incarcerated or committed to those facilities pretty much on a daily basis. And would you say that in your experience that actually people who are not correctional officers or security staff in those facilities are actually more vulnerable to assault by virtue of that fact than they would be if they were security personnel?
Mr. Griffin?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, at the very least, they would be just as vulnerable. As we talked about when I worked at the Minnesota Security Hospital, we all go through the main front door, and it's a big, heavy door, and when it bangs shut, we're all in the same boat, and we all are there to watch each other's backs. So to say, to characterize it as some of those job descriptions being less at risk than security people, I don't think it's a fair characterization. At the very least, they would be just as subject to being assaulted on a daily basis as the security personnel.
Okay. Representative Hilton.
Well, Mr. Chair, I have personal experience with a number of employees in corrections and in the sex offender program, and I am very well aware of the risks that they are submitted to daily, and I think that to try to make this distinction between the exposure that people have in those institutions is just totally wrong-headed and misunderstands the circumstances in which these people work.
Thank you, Mr. Griffin.
Thank you.
Next on the testifiers list, we have Mr. Berg. Hey, Mr. Berg, please state your name for the record for us.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Mark Berg, and I am a State of Minnesota Department of Corrections work crew leader. I have worked in the corrections field for over 18 years. I have worked as a correctional officer, prison transportation trip commander, carpenter, training officer, and now an ICWC crew leader. As a crew leader, I am responsible for supervising offender work crews between 8 and 10 offenders that is contracted by cities or counties to complete various job tasks. The type of work that I have completed is tree cutting and removal, landscaping, building maintenance, general construction, and natural disaster cleanup. The offenders that are assigned to my crew are individuals who have been convicted of a crime and are sentenced to state prison. The offenders on this work crew, on the work crews, are minimum custody and are classified to work in the community. The type of conviction the offenders on my crew range from narcotics to homicide. These type of offenders on the work crews are the same type of offenders that are incarcerated in all of Minnesota correctional facilities. Even though an offender has been classified to minimum status, doesn't mean that the offender has stopped the negative thinking or behaviors. I have had to break up physical altercations, confiscate contraband, and various of other rule violations while being a crew leader. Some of these violations have had severe discipline sanctions, including being returned to the facility and revoking their minimum classification status. As a correction officer will spend an average of 40 hours a week working with offenders. Crew leaders will spend the same amount of time with offenders as well. Unlike the correction officers, the crew leaders supervise the offenders alone outside the secure facility in the community that we work in. Offenders on the work crews are issued various tools needed to complete job tasks that are assigned to them. Some of these tools are hand tools, power tools, saws, knives, chainsaws, and other objects that would be considered dangerous if an offender would possess such item. While working in the community, the crew leader, in addition to his or her normal workload, needs to be diligent to ensure the public safety, city, county worker safety, offender safety, as well as monitor the offender's behavior in public and other situations that could present themselves as a problem. I want to thank the committee for the time to allow me to speak on behalf of the other crew leaders and myself. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Berg. We have one more testifier on the list, and that's Ms. Hughes. And please state your name for the record, Ms. Hughes.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Tammy Hughes. I'm a registered nurse, and I work at the Minnesota Security Hospital in St. Peter. I've worked for the state of Minnesota for 29 years, and I'm here today to talk to you about how this legislation would impact me personally as well as my members, my peers. As a nurse, as a registered nurse in the facility, I wear a radio. I respond to all crises as they come up. I work side by side with the security counselors and my peers in the facility. I have direct personal contact with my patients as I take care of them, whether they're psychotic or not. I need to take care of their needs. I'm one-on-one, close contact, and I spend well more than 75% of my time in direct patient contact. April 7th of 2008, I was assaulted by a patient. I was assaulted. I was hit once from behind and sustained four serious injuries to my discs and my neck and my back. Since that time, I have been declared to be 14% permanently partially disabled. But I continue to work for the facility. This is my job. This is my career. This is what I do, and I do it with pride. When I first started working for the facility, I was an LPN. I wasn't covered by the plan. I was in the general plan. I chose to go back to school and get my registered nurse degree. When I did that, I made the decision to stay with the facility and continue my career as a registered nurse, making less money in this facility and in a highly dangerous environment because I do what I like what I do and I do it very well. My payoff for doing that is having a pension plan that ensures that I will not have to do this job past the age of 55. If I took that hit that I took 3 years ago at the age of 64, I shudder to think what could happen to me at that point. I do not believe nurses should be able, nurses as well as any other person working with this type of offender as well as patients, should be subject to working in that environment past the age of 55 and to be insured the pension and the benefits that we have been promised over the years. My friend is here with me. She's also a nurse, and she was assaulted as well at one point. She was hit seriously in the head, lost a tooth, and has suffered traumatic memories from that response, but continues to go back to work each day. We make decisions in our career based upon the promises that we were given as employment conditions. And I do also want to stress that we strongly oppose this bill and that what we have done in contract negotiations to change who is covered and how long they're covered as far as new employees coming in needing 10 years of vesting in order to be covered in this plan. You can't just come in and work for 3 years and all of a sudden have the benefit. That's not possible. At one time it was. It is not possible anymore. 10 years in order to become part of this plan. So you all obviously are investing your time into a position that you are making into a career. The other thing is that employees that have been in the plan and they come back in the plan, we negotiated that a change in that as well, where they need to stay in the plan for continuous 5 years before they retire. They can't just come back in and next year retire. So there's planning that takes place, and I believe that if there's changes to our benefits, it should be done at the contract table, negotiation, and not here in front of a committee that doesn't fully understand the implications of the members. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hughes. There, Representative Gruenhagen, do you have a question for Ms. Hughes?
I am.
Did you vote for me?
No. Oh. No. That's why we always hesitate to call on Representative Gruenhagen.
Yeah, well, my vote on this bill influence your decision.
All right. So, this being
I have a serious question.
Oh, you have a serious question. Yeah, okay, go ahead, Representative Gruenhagen.
Yeah. Ms. Hughes, I appreciate you visiting with the campaign, but here is the dilemma I see. Okay. Number one, I just want to express my appreciation for everybody who works in a situation like that. I can imagine it's not easy. I understand the dangers with people, especially level three, which you deal with, sex offenders, irrational behavior, violent behavior. you know, so I sincerely appreciate as a representative everybody's service. The problem is, or the situation is, if your retirement plans were defined contributions, okay, the market would automatically solve all the concerns that are trying to be addressed here with the shortfall funding. In other words, the market, we wouldn't have to have these bills. We wouldn't have to have, I believe, this conversation. But since we're dealing with the defined benefit plan, where the benefit is guaranteed and life expectancies have increased, this brings about shortfalls in our public pension plan. And the question begins to come up, who should make up the difference for the shortfall over a projected period of time? And that's where, as a representative, I have to try to balance my decision between the private sector and their ability to pay the taxes to do this versus the public sector and the need for the retirement benefit. And I, you know, from testimony I've heard, I would agree with you. I don't think past 55 is a good age to be working at a place like that. But, you know, so that is the dilemma we face here. Then you add to that the demographic changes that our state and nation are facing. And what I mean by that is the baby boomers, which have been the engine of productivity and the generation generating billions and billions of tax dollars over the last 34 years in the government so that we can do a lot of these things, whether it's Social Security, Medicare, these types of plans. They are now moving from the engine of generation, and there's about 80 million of them. I have to be one of them, but they're moving to where they're going to be drawing on the system. And just about all the studies, and one in the state of Minnesota was done in November 2009 by Tom Gillespie, shows that if we don't get some of these government costs under control, there will be no additional money for K-12, higher education, roads or bridges, or anything else for that matter. So we're facing a fiscal, structural and fiscal deficit for the next decade or more. And the result is that these types of benefit programs ultimately are going to have to be bailed out by the taxpayer, or we're going to have to make some modifications in them. According to according to the amendment that was offered, it doesn't take away anything that you built up to this point, but it does change it going forward as far as your benefit and as far as the benefit level is concerned. If you'd like to respond to that, you
probably should. No, Ms. Hughes, and I know that was sort of a general discussion for this committee, so you can respond if you'd like, but I know that that's... Not, that's a lot for you to answer.
Right. I'm not going to respond to everything there, obviously. I understand the concerns that you have to address in this committee. I very much, you know, I do. But I also need you to understand that had I had the extra 3.8% to invest somewhere, I may have done that totally differently. I'm very proud of the way that the state has governed this pension. I'm very proud of the fact that we don't ask for a bailout in this pension. I'm very proud of the fact that the members and the employer together work to keep this plan viable. And I think that that's something that we will continue to do. We will make modifications as necessary. We will continue to contribute more if necessary or to take back less. Whatever is recommended that we need to do to keep the plan viable, that's what we have been doing. And I think we should continue to do that in this plan. So.
Thank you, Ms. Hughes. And thank you for your testimony. Representative Johnson, I know you wanted to kind of talk to the...
I'll be brief.
Tire
I know,
issue. Talk to the
I'll be brief. Tire I know the chair wants to move things along here a little bit. But I will add another dynamic to working within a facility. We saw this where I worked in a locked facility for 20 years, and that was infectious diseases. We had an outbreak of tuberculosis that affected just about everybody in the institution. We had to be tested every 3 months for 2 years for TB. The guy that housed right next to me, next door, turned out he had TB. He had to go through a 9-month rigorous medical intervention, and he has to deal with that the rest of his life. So there's other issues in addition that you haven't mentioned. And just as a comment, I really think this is inappropriate to go after correctional employee pension plans as a way to deal with our budget deficit. It's at the nickel and dime our folks are working their tails off in corrections is not the way to go. If we need revenue to the state, we need revenue to the state, but we shouldn't be going after our hardworking folks in corrections.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. Representative Cornish renews his motion that House File 1072 be laid over for possible inclusion in a later bill. Representative Cornish, to House File 1161, would you like to move that bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair, members, I'd like to move House File 1161.
Okay.
Representative, be held over at possible inclusion in the omnibus finance bill.
Representative Cornish moves House File 1161 for possible inclusion in a later bill. To the bill, Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chair and members, again, to be transparent, there's nothing hidden here. This bill would make fundamental changes in the direction of the Human Rights Commission or board, so that we could adjust our budget accordingly. And Mr. Diebel, could you go over the mechanics of what this bill does, how it changes the direction of the Human Rights Program?
Mr. Diebel.
Mr. Chair and members, Section 1 of the proposal would eliminate the functions of education and research within the Department of Human Rights and would strike language making the giving priority to contract compliance duties. And so it would be limiting the scope of what the Department of Human Rights would have responsibility for and taking out a directive from the legislature as to how to prioritize their remaining duties. Section 2 goes to the issue of certification, which is a service that is provided by the Department of Human Rights, and it would limit the number of businesses or entities that would be required to be certified by increasing the number of employees from 40 to 50 of the person seeking a certification, as well as whether a contract is in question, raising the amount of the contract from $100,000 to $250,000. And then finally, once the certification is granted, it would require a renewal every 5 years as opposed to the current 2 years. And then the final section of the bill, Section 3, is a repealer. And this is a repeal of a law that requires the Department of Human Rights to provide technical assistance to a contractor whose license was suspended. So again, a mandate removal is the way I would phrase it from the Department of Human Rights, one less function that they would be required by statute to perform.
Representative Cornish, do you have anything further to add?
That's about it for the bill. The direction the bill is taking, and could take any questions if you'd like. Okay. And I imagine we've got testimony.
Yeah. Is there any, would you like to?
Mr. Chairman, I'll wait till the testimony.
Okay, thank you. Put you on the list. This being a public meeting, is there any members of the public who would like to testify in opposition to or in favor of the bill? Okay, seeing none, Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair Cornish, this is a very disturbing bill to me. The state of Minnesota has one of the worst compliance records with our goals for minority hiring of anybody. In fact, we don't meet or come close to the goals, but also we are failing on requiring our contractors to meet those goals. And this would basically aid in gutting the goals that we have to meet minorities and help them get jobs. So this is, to me, that is probably the most important part of the Human Rights Department, because this is the one, while it's important to protect people who are maybe fired or not hired on the basis of the protected categories, it's usually on a one person at a time basis, and this could affect hundreds and hundreds of people that are in the protected classes from being hired.
And so I this is just an incredible step against our goals of helping all people in this state get employment with contractors that work with the state. It's an incredible step backwards.
Representative Cornish? Question in there somewhere?
Just a comment, Representative?
Mr. Chair, we were on comments. I thought that's why that's I waited till the end.
That's fine. Yeah. Representative Hilty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Cornish, could you just give us a brief idea of the rationale for these changes?
Yes, Mr. Chair and members, a brief rationale would be that this commission wasn't set up with the purpose of jobs, economic development. There are set a lot of jobs for people's rights. So to say that this is a jobs commission or human rights, I think is wrong. They don't help people get jobs or keep jobs. They help people defend rights, and that's what they should be doing. And I think it was a feeling of the committee and our group that there was a lot of duplicity, and there's enough organizations out there, and there's enough remedies, and there's states that don't even have this, and organizations like this that seem to do fine. And that's the general feeling why it was put together, the duplicity, too much money going in it for the results, and not enough clientele handled, we thought, to justify the large expenditure. So we were going to change the direction. We're not doing away with the protection. We're just shifting it and redirecting and cutting the budget accordingly, and to be determined by next Tuesday when the spreadsheets come out.
Representative Hilty?
Mr. Chair, just since this is on the record, Representative Cornish, I hate to bring this up, but I think you mean duplication, not duplicity. Duplicity means lying, and I don't think that you're accusing a commission of being rife with lying.
Representative Cornish.
Yeah, I'll take your word for it.
Representative Gaultier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Cornish, was the Department of Human Rights notified of the hearing today?
Okay.
Was anybody from the Department of Human Rights notified about the hearing about this bill today?
Representative Cornish?
I see my committee administrator shaking his head, yes.
Thank you. Representative Johnson?
I'll pass.
Okay. No further discussion? No. Representative Moran?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You stated that there were other organizations like this, and I'm sure you've done some research. So I was just wondering, what are some of the other organizations that does the work that the Human Rights Department do?
Representative Cornish.
Well, I'm under the understanding that there's a number of human rights organizations throughout the state, different at local levels, and also the equal opportunity employment. There's district court remedies. There's I don't know if Mr. Diebel has any idea of the technical names of them, or Mr. Charter.
Mr. Diebel?
I don't have a list of them here today, Representative Moran.
Mr. Diebel?
Mr. Chair and members, I'm not an expert in this area, but I believe some of the larger cities in the state also have human rights departments.
Cool. All right. Representative Johnson?
Mr. Chair, to that point.
Hold on. Representative Moran, do you have...
So
you just want to make sure.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. So you're not eliminating the Department of Human Rights, but you are... So what would be the duties of the commissioner? What would be the what would they be doing?
Representative Cornish.
Representative Moran, I don't mean to be flippant, but I'd rather you just read through the duties yourself here on page 1, 2, and 3 and just take out all the deleted sections. That would give you your answer rather than me reading the bill. It states their mission, the whole direction of the... under the House file, and if you just take out the stricken of the words, you'll have the rest of their duties. So by no means are we getting rid of these people. They can still be advocates and keep their organization intact. It's just we plan to cut back in their budget and redirect it.
Representative Moore, to that point?
Just to the point that the chair and then Mr. Diebel said that there are local ones that do that. They do not do this. They do this type of work only, for instance, the Minneapolis one would do work, this type of work only with regard to contracts with Minneapolis by contractors. They would not do this, which this gets at the contracts with the state.
Representative Moran?
I lost my thought. I didn't write it down.
Well, Representative Moran, we're going to lay this bill over for possible inclusion in a later bill, so you'll have an opportunity to. Representative Hilty, one last.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Cornish, what are the fiscal implications of this bill?
Representative Cornish.
What was the question?
Fiscal implications to the bill? Do you know, Mr. Carter?
Mr. Carter, can you get the savings projected?
Mr. Chair, committee members, we requested a fiscal note on this, and it has not been completed yet. I do not know.
Right. Really quick.
So, Mr. Chair, if we don't know what the fiscal implications are, I presume we will know that before this ends up being included in the omnibus finance bill?
Representative Cornish.
Yes, you will see the spreadsheet come out next Tuesday with the cuts we made to this department, and then you'll have ample opportunity to make amendments and discuss it at length.
So, Mr. Chair, the decision to make these changes in the department weren't related to any kind of fiscal savings, Representative Cornish?
Representative Cornish.
Well, we noticed that during the testimony, we weren't comfortable with a lot of the testimony these people gave when they came up to the microphone and didn't answer a lot of the questions to our satisfaction about the direction they should be taking or were, or the money expended. And so the considerations are policy-wise and they affect the fiscal, yeah. So basically in each organization we went through, we look at, should you really be doing what you're doing? And if we can save money this year by cutting back on the things we don't think you should be, then so that was a decision that we came to. It's probably just a philosophical difference of opinion.
Okay. Let's lay over House File 1161
Mr.
for possible
Chairman,
inclusion.
Just for the record.
Representative Gauthier?
I want to make it really clear, when we talk about duplication, there really isn't any duplication. For example, the City of Duluth has a Department of Human Rights that has no enforcement capability. And basically what it hears is housing complaints under HUD, under a grant. So I want to be clear about that. And I also want to be clear on the record that because we talked at great length about duplication, and the department itself talked about the lack of duplication with the major cities and their departments of human rights. And I also want to make it clear that the department also talked about cuts would put the Department of Human Rights at the tipping point where they would no longer be effective. And this state for years has gone on record saying the protection of human rights is vital to the state and is a major responsibility of the state. So I just want to be on the record for those things.
Thank you, Representative Gauthier. And we'll have an opportunity if this is included in the omnibus bill. So we're going to... Representative Kelly, do you have one more comment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And then we'll get to that.
Chairman Cornish, I'd just like to thank you because I think, actually, Representative Gauthier said it best, because if you look at the language here, the main job of the Human Rights Division is issue complaints, receive and investigate charges alleging unfair discriminatory practices, and determine whether or not probable cause exists, and then help that individual through the process. That's what we have the Human Rights Department for. And what you're actually doing is relieving them of a mandate that says they have to do everything else, which would take away from them being able to help that individual who has been unfairly discriminated against. So I believe you're actually helping to focus the department on what we would really like them to do, and I thank you for your efforts.
We'll Representative Moran, we'll be able to talk about this, because
really
we've got one more bill to attend to, so I'll give you 1 minute. How's that?
Okay. And I think thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the duties, what we are eliminating, in my opinion, is the formal and informal education of groups around intergroup conflicts. I think that is the work that we do. I don't think there's any other group that comes in educate people of the ignorance around human rights and discrimination. And this is one of their biggest jobs and tasks that they do, which is not an easy job to do. And so I think that is one of the priorities of the Department of Human Rights.
Okay, thank you, Representative Moran. House File 1161 will be laid over for possible inclusion in a later bill. Representative Cornish, House File 981, I understand you want to move that before the committee.
House File 981, I'd like to move that for possible inclusion to the omnibus bill.
Okay. Representative Cornish moves House File 981 and for possible inclusion in a later bill. To your bill, Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chair and members, this is a highly complex situation, and although I'm familiar with catching bad guys and bagging and tagging evidence, I'm not prepared to tackle a subject like DNA testing. So this is a familial DNA, some of you have heard about, some not, and so I'd like to turn it over to my testifiers to tell the need for this bill, and we will have the opposition if we might run a little overtime for those people who are worried about the noon hour, but rather than come back tomorrow, I'm sure you'd all appreciate going a little long today. So
I'm sure we
but
can
we
all
will shorten up the testimony and the opposition testimony probably to reasonable length. Thank you, sir.
Sheriff, would you like to state your name for the record for us?
Sure. Good morning. My name is Rich Stanek, Hennepin County Sheriff. Thank you, Representative Cornish, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee for giving us this time this morning. We know we're running short on time, so we'll try and make it brief, and I'll try and encapsulate some of the other comments. The Hennepin County Sheriff's Office operates one of two accredited crime labs that process DNA in the state of Minnesota. The lab located at the Hennepin County Sheriff's Office, and of course, the lab at the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. With me this morning is Dave Bjerga, the superintendent of the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. I have talked with both Jim Franklin, executive director of Minnesota Sheriff's Association. The Sheriff's Association is supportive of this legislation, and I believe the County Attorneys Association is also here if there are some additional questions that they might be able to answer. They've been working with us on the crafting of this specific language. This legislation, Mr. Member and Chairs, would authorize the use of familial DNA search in the state of Minnesota for certain violent crimes. A few of the other states are already doing this, like Virginia and California. Colorado have written up standards and policies on its use. Up to 13 states, also including New York, Florida, and Texas, are using this familial DNA in some capacity, although they do not have formal policies developed. The use of DNA, Mr. Chair, members, to solve crimes has proven to be a very useful tool, as you know, as well as used to exonerate some. Familial DNA searches allow law enforcement to use the advances in forensic sciences. Familial DNA searches do not, however, permit the collection or authorize the collection of additional DNA from people just because they are family members of a convicted felon, and we've had a chance to visit with a number of you individually in your offices to help try and further that educational piece. Law enforcement is still taking evidence from a crime scene, and of course we're running it against the convicted offender database, also known as CODIS. But rather than only looking for identical matches in some extreme and violent crimes, a murder, rape, a missing child under suspicious circumstances, and I believe, Mr. Chair, that Representative Cornish has an amendment at some point here this morning, where we have no other leads, this bill would authorize the BCA to come back to us with partial matches. And let me explain how this might work in brief. You wake up one morning to find a broken window in your six-year-old daughter's bedroom and your daughter is missing. We can all imagine what that might be like. Hopefully we never have to go through that, though. Blood is found on the broken window glass, and that evidence is brought into, in this case, the Hennepin County Sheriff's Office, where DNA is extracted. That DNA profile, Mr. Chair and members, is run against the BCA's database for convicted felony offenders to see if there's an identical match. Right now, if there's not an identical match, that's it. Investigators have nowhere else to go once they've exhausted all other investigative leads, and that case remains unsolved. But with this bill, though, in a case like that, where you have a missing six-year-old child who was abducted from your home in the middle of the night, when it comes back with no identical match, we now have the ability, through forensic sciences and technology, a second search could be requested, one that would identify a potential familial match. And that would run against the same crime scene evidence against the same database of convicted felony offenders that this state has authorized us to collect. But this time, a slightly different search would attempt to determine if the individual who left the crime scene sample has a relative who may be in the offender database. Now, that gives investigators, our police officers and deputy sheriffs and state agents out on patrol, an opportunity to do some additional investigative work to determine if there's a connection, where a person might live, age of the person, and begin putting together the pieces of the puzzle. In other words, giving us another piece of circumstantial evidence to further the case to find that missing child. They still need to prove their case. They would still need to get a court order to obtain a DNA sample from a suspect in order to confirm a match with that collected from a crime scene. This doesn't change any of those current standards as set by the courts. Law enforcement simply wants to make sure we have the ability to use this tool of technology and sciences to solve those crimes. We realize, as Mr. Chair laid out, that Mr. Chair, Mr. Representative, you're both here today, that this is a pretty complex area of science, and that's why we believe the specifics about how this would be implemented, putting in place processes and procedures, should be done through the BCA superintendent rulemaking process. This bill asks the legislature to provide some overall policy direction on this issue and allows the BCA to establish particulars on how it will be implemented. You know, I simply want to be sure, Mr. Chair and members, that law enforcement has this tool available the next time we have a high-profile crime like this, and that really, at the end of the day, no crime victim or surviving family member should ever have to go to bed at night wondering where their missing child might be or fearful that an attacker might still be out there. Superintendent Bjerga and I have worked a number of cases over the years. We can tell you story after story after story where this might have been very useful here in Minnesota. The time has come to take a hard look at this, a policy look at this, ask you as the policy on behalf of the people of Minnesota to take this into consideration. With that, Mr. Chair and members, Superintendent Bjerga is here. I know you want to say something about this. So.
Before we get to that testimony, Mr. Bjerga, we need to do a little housekeeping here on Amendment A1. Representative Cornish, would you like to move your amendment?
Yes, Mr. Chair and members, I'd like to move the A1 amendment for adoption to House File 981.
Okay. Any discussion on the A1 amendment? Hearing none. All those in favor of the A1 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. All those opposed? Okay. The amendment is approved, and the House File 981 is now in the order in which the author would like it. Mr. Bjerga, go ahead.
Good morning, sir. My name is Dave Bjerga, and I'm the Acting Superintendent of the Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. I know time is short, so I'll be very brief here. Technology has evolved to the point now where we would be remiss if we didn't take advantage of it. At the BCA, we currently house the CODIS, as the sheriff alluded to, the combined DNA index system that the searches are conducted against. And I think the role of the BCA here is to identify technology that would provide efficiency. Provide information accurately, and ultimately provide investigators with meaningful leads in extraordinary cases where all of the leads have been exhausted. And I know that that's a subjective term, but this is a very small number of cases per year that we anticipate. I've looked at the California and the Colorado models, and they both do a minimal amount of number of cases per year. Without getting into the science of it, there are some safeguards here regarding some privacy issues, and then the rules for case submission will have to be adopted or developed and adopted. I looked at the Colorado Bureau policy, and there's a page and a half in there on dealing with the privacy and the ultimate investigation of the leads as they're given back to the investigators. So we're going to try and cover that as we move forward here. And I think that it's just time for Minnesota to take a lead in this.
Thank you, Mr. Bjerga. We also have on the testifier list, Ms. Funk. And would you like to wait for testimony? Okay. Ms. Funk, if you can come down and testify. Representative Hilty, do you have a question for Sheriff or Sheriff Stanek?
It may be, Mr. Chair. I think it's actually a question for Mr. Diebel initially, but I'm interested to know what the rulemaking provisions of Chapter 14 that are not subject to this bill actually are.
Mr. Diebel, do you have? We'll give him a moment here to look that up, Representative Hilty, and get back to.
Thank you.
Representative Johnson, do you have a question for Mr. Bjerga?
Just a quick question to the Deputy Commissioner. Regarding your current DNA collection, do you presently have a backlog of felony DNA that has not been processed?
Mr. Bjerga?
I would have to defer to our lab director on that, sir. I'm not sure of the answer on that. This is the known offender database that we're searching, is what I can tell you. I could answer you very quickly. No. That's why we have people, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Bjerga. Let's have Ms. Funk come down and testify.
I previously had discussed the limit with the testifier of 5 minutes.
Okay. All right. Ms. Funk, because of the hour, we're already past our normal time here. If we can limit testimony to 2 minutes, and we will have another opportunity to discuss this as well. So go ahead, Ms. Funk.
Do my best, Mr. Chairman, members. The short version of my credentials is I serve on a White House subcommittee on ethics, education, and and training for forensic scientists. I train all over the world. I am the sole state representative on a 5-attorney member panel that wrote the seminal document on DNA for defense attorneys, which will be posted at dna.gov shortly under grant at the National Institute of Justice. I've been working with DNA evidence in forensic cases since 1995. I would like the members to be aware that in 2008, the Federal Bureau of Investigation held a 2-day seminar inquiring of the shareholders of the value and the dangers of familial searches. And at the end of the day, the FBI concluded that they would not do familial searches. Why? The people who are in our databases are people who have been in Minnesota convicted of felonies. And so there's an argument that says for public policy, for safety, we need to extend genetic surveillance on these people forever. Familial searching expands genetic surveillance beyond those who have committed crimes. And familial searching has a failure rate of 90%. Now, I want you to understand what that means. When they're looking in the offender database and comparing it to a crime scene sample, looking to see if they can find someone who's a close match, that doesn't mean that 9 times out of 10, no one pops up. They've done some studies on that. If you look at half of a person's genetic profile and compare it to a dad, let's say you're looking, you have an evidence sample, you've got 26 pieces of information at best. If you're looking for 13, you will find that 3% of your database will match by chance. Not because they or a family member committed this crime, but just by chance. Because while a full profile is extremely rare, the alleles or the markers that make up a given profile are not. If you change the parameters, so 3% of our Minnesota database of 100,000 people approximately means you're going to get 3,000 potential suspects, none of whom actually have a relative who participated in this crime. If you limit it instead looking for 13 markers, only one at each location, so we're looking specifically parent to child, you'll find that number changes to about 1 in 2,000. With a database of 100,000 people, that means we can expect 50 people whose relatives were not involved in this crime to come up in this familial search. So it's not just people who've committed crimes and their relatives, but it's people who were not participating in this particular crime, people whose relatives weren't participating in this particular crime, that will be subject to investigation. An article published in Science magazine in 2006 stated what I want to make sure really is obvious, which is this: if we use DNA matching statistics, it will lead to the investigation of innocent people. Separate issue. When I started doing DNA cases, you needed a blood spot about the size of a quarter to get a DNA profile. That has changed dramatically in the last 15 years. These days, the fact that I am up here and speaking, the result is some of my saliva landing right here on this table. And you can find my DNA profile here, not just this morning, but this afternoon, perhaps this evening, perhaps later in the week. There's a file that is kept in all good crime labs documenting contamination that occurs by the scientists into casework. It happens, I would not say in every case, obviously not. It happens enough that there are federal guidelines suggesting that a separate file be kept documenting when scientists well-trained with access to a 10% bleach solution wearing gloves and masks and lab coats inadvertently have their own DNA contaminate files. If it happens at the crime lab, we must understand that the transference of DNA is happening out in public all the time. They did a study on what happens if a man kisses his wife on the cheek and she goes running, and someone wearing rubber gloves strangles her and discards those rubber gloves. You'll be able to find the husband's DNA on those gloves. So the significance, even if you can find a match, is questionable when we're talking again of a 90% failure rate in even finding a match.
Ms. Funk, if I can just give you 30 seconds to kind of wrap up. We have some other testifiers. We want to make sure I have time for them.
Understood. Just real briefly, finally, using familial searches disproportionately will impact minority communities. Because African Americans are disproportionately in the database, the number of family members who would be subject to genetic surveillance is significantly higher in the African American population. About 17% would now be subject to genetic surveillance in the African American population. Contrast approximately 4%, again, of people who have not committed any crime who could be subjected to genetic surveillance in the Caucasian population should familial searching go through. And one last thing, despite the reference to a number of states utilizing familial searching, Kamala Harris said yesterday, Attorney General of California, that it's been successful twice. I have been able to locate two additional cases that I think familial searching may have been used, but this is not going to open the floodgates on convictions. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Funk. And Mr. Diebel, to Representative Hilty's question, are you prepared for an answer?
Mr. Chair and members, the Chapter 14 is entitled Administrative Procedure, and it provides 69 sections of guidance on how to pass and create rules. So it would the general direction in the bill is that the department would be absolved from all of those obligations.
And so then, Mr. Chair, Mr. Diebel, does that mean that there would be any criteria that they had to follow, or can they just make rules however they please?
Mr. Diebel?
Mr. Chair and members, I'm not an expert in rulemaking, but they couldn't be held to the standard that is created in statute as far as giving notice, public hearings, and the other timelines that are provided. So that would be, obviously, it would make it easier for them to enact rules, and they're obligated to do so, but they wouldn't be obligated to necessarily comply with the directives from the legislature regarding rulemaking.
Mr. Chair? Representative Cornish, any plans to refer this bill to government operations?
Representative Cornish.
I have no plans at this time, no.
Let's hear from...
So, Mr. Chair, I guess what that means is that not only are we excluding a reference to rules here, but we're also excluding our reference to the House rules that say that any bill that refers to rulemaking needs to go to the Government Operations Committee.
We'll take that under advisement, Representative Hilty. Let's hear from Ms. Jackson. And Ms. Jackson, we do have your letter in our packets.
Okay, thank you. Good morning. And
my phone's going off. Not to mention the Empire Striking Back.
Good morning. My name is Carolyn Jackson. I'm the lobbying coordinator for the ACLU of Minnesota. And I will limit, you have my written testimony, I want to limit it to two policy points. The first is mission creep. At first, we only allowed gathering DNA from an individual under warrant for a particular crime. Then we increased it to crimes where convicted felons for sex crimes, because DNA evidence is so prevalent as part of an investigation of a sex crime. Then we increased that to murder as well. And now we're looking to increase it to, and I don't have the full list of the amendment passed today, but it's a pretty broad list and rather vague. So we're vastly increasing the gathering of this very, very personal data. DNA is your blueprint. That's who you are. And when the state takes that for inclusion in a criminal investigation, it's an extremely invasive situation. And the question is, what's the crisis? Why are we doing this now? What crisis are we solving? Why are we doing this massive invasion of this extremely personal information to solve what crisis? Crime is dropping. We have the crime rate of 1967. That means that crime is lower than almost my entire life. And I don't see a crisis. I don't see a spate of kidnappings occurring. My children go walking around in perfect safety. And Sheriff Stanek's been doing his job very well. I don't see a crisis in encouraging this broad expansion of a very private situation. The other thing is, a lot of you were elected on a platform of decreasing government. And this gives incredible discretion to government bureaucrats to set the rules and the standards about when we can use this without any legislative oversight or public comment. And so I would strongly urge you on those two policy reasons alone to defeat this bill. Thank you,
Ms. Jackson. Representative Leidiger, did you have a question for Ms. Jackson?
Yes, I do. Ms. Jackson, I'm not sure what the ACL is doing these days, but, I mean, I've been sitting here listening to the increase in the trafficking issues that we've got going on in human trafficking. In fact, there are some serious crimes that are going on all over, and I cannot help but to keep hearing what the sheriff just said about these cases of kidnapping and the scenario that he brought out. I mean, if we have this technology that we have invested billions of dollars to create, I would think that we would want to use this technology to its fullest in order to investigate, especially in cases where basically we've hit the end of the trail, and we need to start opening up new possibilities. Here we have this electronic or this process that we could use that could increase, in my view, increase the speed of the investigation, and that what this bill does, which I think is a great bill, it opens up another tool for law enforcement to use, and I would think that the ACLU would want to support something like this.
Ms. Jackson, to the billions of dollars that have been spent.
Mr. Chairman, well, there are a number of questions in that statement. The billions of dollars invested, I don't know if there's a fiscal note on this, but it's my understanding that the BCA DNA lab is very, very busy. Now, they may not have a backlog currently on processing the data, but I know that they are extremely overworked and that this will increase their workload exponentially. And slow down their ability to do direct matches when they're doing these broad familial matches. And it was my understanding that this would be a huge cost in the BCA to implement this. As far as the number of crimes, if you were listening carefully, Sheriff Stanek had a hypothetical crime. He did not talk about any specific crime. The crime statistics that I state come from the uniform crime reports. You can go online and see them. And the crime rate in Minnesota is at the same rate it was approximately in 1967. And that's, you can just look that up on the thing. And I'm not sure that this would increase the speed in any way, shape, or form of an investigation. And we're extremely concerned with privacy, yeah. And that's why we're against this.
Thank you, Ms. Jackson. We are 15 minutes overdue here, so.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, go ahead.
What I'd like to do is, if it's okay with you, would be to change the order here and bring down Mr. Dolish from the crime lab. I want to do away with some of the boogeyman black helicopter theories that have been presented here so far today.
Okay, to the boogeyman black helicopter issue. And please state your name for the record.
Chairman, committee members, my name is Frank Dolish. I'm the director of the BCA laboratory. I guess what I would like to respond to some of the earlier testimony here, this process of familiar searching is more than just looking at the database. That's the first phase of it. We will have to develop, and those states that are doing this have additional software that they use to narrow down the thousands of potential or partial matches that Christine Funk was talking about. So that would be narrowed to a smaller number. Then we would go back to the actual offender samples and run another DNA analysis on those samples called YSTR. So we'd be looking at another portion of the DNA to further determine whether or not these partial matches might be a relative or not And at the end of the day, as the sheriff indicated, we'd probably look at other information that we have to narrow it further. So the names that might be released to law enforcement for further investigation, that does not mean that they committed the crime. They're just going to look into to this, would be on the order of maybe a dozen to 50 at the most, but probably a dozen to two dozen names.
Thank you, Mr. Dolish. I know we have a member of the public. Do you have a question for Mr. Dolish? I want to make sure we get to the members
Mr.
of the
Chair,
public.
For each case, are you talking about, or in a whole year?
Mr. Dolish?
We would be doing the statistical analysis and the YSTR on any of the samples that were identified in a particular case, and you're probably aware that there is a fiscal note that the BCA submitted on this, and those costs primarily are for the supplies to do the additional testing, the YSTR testing, and developing the software that would narrow this search down to a much smaller and manageable number.
Representative Johnson, did you have a question for Mr. Dolish?
Yeah, question for Mr. Dolish. What does the term sufficient genetic similarities mean exactly? It seems like a broad concept.
Mr. Dolish?
Yes, it is. And one of the reasons that I feel that we need to have some rulemaking is that we would establish what part of those rules would be scientific parameters that we would establish narrow down the number of people that would be included in a particular search.
Thank you, Mr. Dolish. I know that Mr. Neumeister is here as well from the public to testify. If you're still in the room, would like to testify.
I have a question for him.
Okay. Let's get back to him in just a moment, because I want to make sure that we get Mr. Neumeister's testimony here, and then we'll get Mr. Dolish back on.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Rich Neumeister. For those people who I've not met before, I've been a leading advocate on privacy and civil liberties and open government for almost 30 years in this place. And so I want to share with you my comments about the bill. Thank you for the opportunity to make comment. Sheriff Stanek has argued that there is no need for legislation in general because the law has already says that, and he's said that publicly, and to some extent he wants some issues to be clarified. But from my perspective, there's more than just that, and you just passing this legislation and punting it off to the BCA to do it. The legislature needs to take a hold of this issue and to give specific direction as how it's to be done with accountability and transparency. And one of the things inside the bill is it exempts it from Chapter 14. So there really is no public input for the opportunity for it. Lawyers, civil libertarians, anybody to make comments about the proposed rules. Now, I handed to you, and what you have in your package is some of the California rules. They were basically the first state that really went on the forefront of this. Two states ban it, or two government entities, Maryland, D.C. bans it. California took a lot of input from a cross-section of folks, and then their Department of Justice then came out with these rules. I don't see that happening with the proposal here. I was here in 1989 working with Frank Dolish and your colleagues to help develop the current DNA law, which is being amended here. That was done in 1989. Since 89, there have been a lot of changes in DNA. This is one of the first expansion that's coming to that. They're already now in the chutes to selling to law enforcement diagnostic tools to take a look at a crime sample and to see maybe they can get a disease like Gaucher's disease, or the color of someone's eyes, which could be used for to get a suspect. I have no problem with that, but let's have a full public discussion about that, which I don't think that it's happening. In 89, we set this up only for sex offenders in the samples. The object was not to, as it's being contemplated here, the BCA would be used to produce leads to siblings, fathers, sons, and family members who come under suspicion where their constitutional rights and privacy could be compromised. This bill is to be limited for major murder or sex crimes, and now with the amendment that's adopted, that's fine. But as I indicated to you, the BCA superintendent is the sole decision maker, no public input. Now, one of the things that if you take a look...
Mr. Neumeister, excuse me just real quick. I'm going to give you 30 seconds. We're actually going to lose this room because we're about 20 minutes in, and I really wanted to get your opinion, but I'm going to give you 30 seconds, and then we're going to lay this bill over.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, I just share with you at least two proposals. We have one proposal here, which I saw, the first proposal that the sheriff's office had, included a sign-off by the local county attorney that it's above board and some other things, accountability, transparency. But the second draft does not have that, and it's basically no check. So, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I think what it's important is take a deep breath, look at it a little bit, and I'll agree with Sheriff Stanek. And I've interacted with Sheriff Stanek for a decade and a half. This issue is complex, but if you pass this bill, let's not compromise our liberties of privacy, presumption of innocence, and right to due process. And I'll share with you. I'm not no boogeyman, and I'm not no black helicopter, because if I'd been doing that for 33 years here at this legislature, I would have been kicked out a long time ago. But I have had a lot of impact because of your openness and the open process that you have here to hear people out. So I hope you just don't rush this bill, kick it, but have some discussion, and I'm more than happy to discuss a lot of things with you because I have tons of information and research.
Mr. Schmeister, I appreciate your testimony, and I think it certainly is very insightful, so I appreciate that. We're going to, Chairman Cornish, do you have a...
Yeah, just before you lay it over, I'd just say there's a lot of good testimony. There's some completely fabrication, misinformation testimony given here today, and just keep in mind this is a convicted offender database that they're searching, and if it only solved two cases, what somebody so flippantly referred to, I'm sure if one of those cases was your missing child, you'd take quite a bit different look at it. So thank you.
Thank you, Chairman Cornish. House File 981 is laid over for possible inclusion in a later bill. Just lay it. We're just going to lay it over.
Laid over.
Thank you. And this committee is adjourned.